You're listening to Camera Dojo, the official podcast of CameraDojo.com, where we help you make the most out of your photography. This is your host, Kerry Garrison. And this week, we've got a very special guest, but I'll get to that in just a moment. I want to also point out our upcoming workshops that we've got going. I've got a couple of workshops that people might be interested in attending. They're going to both be in January. And the first one is, it's short. It's just a couple hours. It's going to be at the Tri-Community College of Photography in Covina, California. It's only $15. If you're interested in doing a portrait lighting workshop, it's highly recommend it. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to show how to do portrait lighting techniques and all that good jazz. It's going to be a lot of fun. So that's at the Tri-Community College of Photography in Covina. If you go to cameradojo.com and click on workshops, you'll find more information about this and the other workshop that I'm really, really excited about. Myself and Jules Bianchi, amazing wedding photographer, are going to do a all-day workshop in Anaheim, California at a place called the White House, which is a half-scale replica of the White House. Absolutely gorgeous inside. Amusement park outside. It's a place called Hobby City. Really fun place to shoot. And the first half of the day is kind of the traditional lecture seminar style with us demoing all the techniques and talking about what we're doing and how to do it. And then we're going to split up and do hands-on. So Jules will take people into the amusement park to show engagement shots and wedding photography. And I'm going to take people inside the White House and we're going to do portraiture lighting, all the techniques, all hands-on. Bring your cameras, get all the shots. And then we're going to switch so everybody gets a chance to do both the studio style and the more dynamic stuff outside. So this is the Light, Location, and Love workshop with Jules Bianchi and Kerry Garrison, January 26th in Anaheim. Again, more information, you can go to cameradojo.com or go to julescafe.com, J-U-L-E-S, cafe.com, Jules Cafe, and you can get information about either one of these workshops. They're both going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to them. So, who is our big special guest this week? Well, he is the author of a new book called The Accidental Millionaire, How to Succeed in Life Without Really Trying. This is Gary Fong, and I'm sure many of you have heard the name, have read his stuff, have used his products, the Light Sphere, the Origami, or some of the other ones that are out. So as soon as we get back from the break, we'll be on with Gary Fong. Today, we are here with Gary Fong, and if you are in the wedding photography business and you haven't heard who Gary is, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, he's a big name in the wedding photography business, but I'm going to turn it over to Gary. And well, first off, Gary, thank you for joining us. I know you're really busy, especially with the new book out, but thank you for taking the time to come on the show and talk to everybody. But why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself, without going into the detail that you have in your book. How's that sound?
Yeah, okay, because that would be quite a long thing. I was born in the hospital, and well, let's see. As you probably know, I was a wedding photographer for 20 years and quit at the end of that, mostly because the music was really starting to get to me. For some reason, they always play songs from the same era in the 80s. I don't know. They just stopped there. You know, it's like, celebrate good times. Come on.
Sweet Caroline.
I know. Like, I don't know. So, but really, that was one of the things that just drove me nuts. I had a friend who was a DJ, and I just couldn't believe that he could just do it. And he says he doesn't even hear it anymore. So, but yeah. So after that, I started other businesses, which were nice. It was the minute that I stopped really having goals or setting myself to focus on certain things that life took the bizarre path that it shows in the book. one thing led to another, and they were all completely unexpected.
Now, so you brought up the book. The book is called The Accidental Millionaire, How to Succeed in Life Without Really Trying. And I'm not quite sure how to describe this. Is it almost an anti-self-help book?
Yeah, that's kind of the funny thing, because that's the way that the publicist presented it to me. She said that I've taken the motivational story and turned it upside down. I had some person who read the book and then actually came to one of my speeches say, "Thank you so much for the inspiration. I'm going to do absolutely nothing." I don't know what to think of that. But what happened was is basically in writing the book, I just told the story of what happened in my circumstance. And what honestly happened, the reason why they came up with the title, How to Succeed in Life Without Really Trying, because at first I bristled about the title. When you sell your rights to a publisher, they can do pretty much what they want with the book to make it marketable or anything once they own the rights. And they came up with the title, The Accidental Millionaire, How to Succeed in Life Without Really Trying. It was hard for me to accept that for a while, because it sounded like I spilled coffee on myself at McDonald's and sued them or something, or slipped and fell at a big chain store or something. But what they basically meant to say was, what they were picking up on is the first part of the book was a lot of me being goal-oriented. I was either trying to fulfill goals that were set for me by my parents, and then after that, in response to all that, I set goals for myself and pretty much failed at every single one. A lot of the book talks about jobs that I had gotten fired from and things like that. And it's whenever I tried to match the expectations of myself or others is when things got really funny. That's, I'll set myself out to do certain things or try to please somebody else and do certain things. And that's when all of these comical things started to happen. And then at the time I turned about 30, I had a really, really crushing blow of circumstances, one right after another. And at that point, I said I almost crashed into a car, and there was a bumper sticker on this car, and it said, "Since I gave up hope, I feel much better." From that moment, I actually started to laugh really loud and gave up hope. And the book describes how I kind of dropped out of society for a while. I had a studio manager who I said, I'm not really capable of shooting weddings anymore because I'm just kind of going through a really messed up stage. So why don't you take over and shoot? And I went down to Club Med in the Bahamas to just kind of get away from the world. And then I started teaching tennis. And once I got that whole thing out of my system, I kept that. It was really easy once you just stop trying to keep the stop trying. I actually became the slacker that I never was. I was always goal-oriented. And then from that moment on, it's almost like if you have a really empty cup, for some reason it gets filled by other wonderful things. But if you're constantly trying to keep your cup filled, you push away any opportunities that might actually be coming right around the corner. And as soon as I gave up expectations and gave up hope, well, stopped setting goals for myself, then from that moment on, one thing happened after another. And it was a really awesome string of success.
Yeah, in reading that, it certainly comes across in a particular way in how your life turned out. But I don't think that's really meant to say you shouldn't have any goals and just sit around on your couch watching TV waiting for things to happen. You need to have a direction, but be willing to see the things that are coming along the sidelines and be prepared for them should they arrive.
That's true. And I think the motto that it comes up toward the end of the book where I say, instead of saying be prepared, I turned it into be preparing, because while I'm kind of like preparing for something, I was actually preparing for something else, but I didn't know what was coming yet.
And the whole time I was reading it, I kept thinking in my mind, the quote, "Chance favors the prepared mind," and you actually brought it up right at the end of the book.
Correct. Yeah, that's true.
Because I think that's a powerful message. I've always told like my kids and things that, you know, be prepared should opportunity knock, be willing to open that door, you know, otherwise you're going to miss out on opportunities. I look back on my life and how many times I look back and go, man, if I only had, you know, not been so directed on what I was doing and I saw these other things come up, and who knows what could have happened with those things. And it's a good message to not be so focused, but at least be moving in a direction so you're accomplishing something.
Well, that was the part that was in the book I talked about, my meeting with this inventor named Enzo. And that was a really fateful moment for me, because this guy was a multimillionaire. And just, you know, he had this life that I couldn't ever imagine. You know, he had a yacht and he had multiple homes, and all he did all day was just kind of sit around and invent, which kind of became my life much, much later. But when I asked him, I said, Enzo, how is it that you can just come up with such amazing things? And he said, well, it's a lot easier than you think. And I said, really? Because I'd love to learn, because I think you're a fascinating guy. He said, well, for example, you know, the suitcase that you just carried in, I had just come in off the plane. I had one of those old Samsonite sky blue suitcases with the handle and all that. And put it down next to him as we were talking. He said, look at that crazy thing. What would you do to it to improve it? I said, the suitcase? You know, I mean, it's a suitcase. How do you improve the suitcase? It was just like probably anything that you don't dare redefine it, because you just always take for granted that it's a suitcase and that's what it will forever be. He said, what would you do to improve it? And I said, well, I think it's, now that I think about it, it's kind of weird that it doesn't have wheels, right? I mean, I have to carry this thing around long distances sometimes. It'd be neat if it had wheels. And he goes, well, there you go. Why not have integrated wheels? And I said, that's a very good point. I don't know why nobody does that. He said, what else would you do to it? And I said, well, if it had wheels, it'd be neat if it had a telescoping handle, so I don't have to stoop over and when I'm wheeling it around. He goes, that too. And then he said, what else would you do? And I said, well, I can imagine if I'm kind of dragging this up some stairs, it'd be neat if it had kind of a hard skid plate, so that rather than scuffing the fabric, I could just kind of like, you know, pull it up a flight of stairs and it wouldn't get scratched up. And he said, and there you have it. That's how you become an inventor. Now take this present and do something with it. And I said, okay, great. At the moment, I was focused on reaching a goal in my mind of filling up some empty dates that I had in my July wedding photography calendar. And that was more pressing on my mind at that moment. And so completely forgot about it. And of course, this conversation predated the intellectual property rights for the integrated suitcase with the wheels and the telescoping handles. What I'm saying is he gave me this idea that I mean, can you imagine if I patented the wheeled suitcase with the handle? What would have happened? But at the moment, I was just too focused on being having a good July. And so I spent all my time trying to make my little wedding photography business just a teeny bit more successful and missing the grand scheme. So when that happened, I swore to myself, if I ever get an idea again, I don't care, I'm going to just not let this happen. I mean, I lived with the pain of not patenting the suitcase. So I just swore that I was going to do whatever I could to make sure that didn't happen again.
What's the best way that you can prepare yourself to see those opportunities when they come up?
Well, number one, to have no expectations, because as I said in the book, it's this having expectations that closes us off to all the things that might be out there. I remember for quite a few years, I was a follower of Zig Ziglar, and he was just a huge influence on me, saying that, you know, you can't get anywhere without having goals. You have to write down, you know, put your goals in writing. You have to have a deadline on your goal, and you have to put leverage against yourself to make sure that the goal happens. So my life was one disappointment after another because I was trying to set goals. And the thing I started to realize that is that it's impossible to be disappointed if you have no expectations. And that's a huge, huge liberating kind of a paradigm shift for me. The other thing too is that when you have these goals and you satisfy them, when you hit a goal, you're just merely relieved. It doesn't make your life incredibly wonderful or to your amazement. And one example that I bring in the book, I know you read it and you'll remember this story, but the girl who tried to book me for a wedding and she didn't have a groom yet.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah, it was amazing, you know, and you know, she shared with me that she went through the same kind of Zig Ziglar goal setting seminar where, you know, if you want something to happen, and the thing that she wanted to happen was she didn't want to be single in her 30s. So she booked a June wedding just before her 30th birthday. And she set that deadline, which, of course, was June 22nd. And she put the goal in writing. And the third part to the Zig Ziglar approach was have leverage against yourself so that you'll make the goal happen. Well, with her, that leverage was the thought of walking down the aisle with no man standing at the end of it. That was a powerful motivator, I'm sure. But to me, that was a symptom of goals gone wild, because she, you know, I could just imagine dating this woman and having her say, okay, you know, the two of us have some chemistry. We seem to have shared values. I like your set of teeth. And what are you doing June 22nd next year? You know, by the time he finds that out, he would just realize that he was just a prop in her inner goal. And I don't think life works that way.
Well, you, in the book, you certainly share some of the misfortunes as well as the things that have gone well. So it shows that it's not an easy path to just give up and look at the broad spectrum of things. It's actually a process that you had to go through over a long period of time.
Correct. And but the way I see it is this, and you mentioned about this being a process. If you come to a fork in the road where you have to make a decision, there's actually three possible outcomes. You could do something and it doesn't go well, but you learn from it. That's positive. Or you do something and it was a good decision and then you gain from it. That's also positive. The worst thing you could do is come to a fork in the road and make no decision, because you've made no movement. You can't possibly win because you haven't done anything. And the third thing is you can't learn if you do mess up. So doing anything, making any kind of decision, two out of three, becomes an opportunity versus sitting around, which is what a lot of people do. And I use my father as a great example, because it was interesting when I read Guy Kiyosaki's book, him having an Asian parent, very, very similar to my story in that the generation before mine was all about preservation and being careful and not losing what little you had. My generation, after witnessing what my dad, all the opportunities that my dad missed out on, was not losing the opportunity to do something when it comes up to you. And so, yeah, whenever something appeared that looked like it was something worth doing, I had to do it, but it didn't always work out. But then in the end, I learned something that turned it into something that I could benefit later in this process of be preparing.
That was actually something that I really related to, because I've worked for a number of technology startup companies, and one of them in particular almost went out of business because upper management was so afraid about making bad decisions that they wouldn't make decisions.
Right.
And I kept saying to them, not making a decision is inherently a bad decision.
Correct.
If you don't do anything, you can't succeed and you can't learn. And you said it exactly that way in the book. And that's a hard concept for some people to grasp. But that is a really key point of the book there, is you have to make decisions. And if you screw up, oh well, you learn from it, move on, and you won't make the same mistake next time.
There's another aspect to that, too, because when you decide that you're going to give up expectations, and that's really my main message in the book, decision-making becomes less crucial, less important, because if you have expectations, then, you know, it really actually messes up your decision-making ability, because you make a decision because you expect it will improve things. And anything that becomes expectation-driven creates stress. And that's what's happening with your management. They're saying, look, we've got to do something. It goes that way with inventing. You can't sit down and say, I've got to invent something. It never works that way. In fact, the less you try to come up with an idea, the more they come in. But if you really, really try, that becomes stressful. And the stress actually drives away the ability to do anything. And making decisions in a stress-free manner is just basically saying, I'm going to do A or B. And you may recall in the book that I actually tossed a coin on one of the largest decisions of my entire life. knowing that sitting here and stressing out about a decision is going to mess up this decision-making process. So I'm just going to let the universe make the decision for me, and I tossed a coin. But not really worrying about the outcome is a great way to take the pressure off of decision-making. At least you move forward.
But looking at that section of the book, when you talked about that, you also said that either way, you're going to be happy with the outcome. Either one was okay at some level. If you had that situation and you go, well, one of these is really bad, then you've already made that decision. I don't see why so many people struggle with that.
Well, it's about safety. And if I didn't have such a good example of a wonderful, wonderful man who wanted to keep everything, what little that he had, that's my father, and he taught me great lessons about saving money, which I think are just awesome lessons. But if I didn't see how much it cost him to be cautious, then I wouldn't have learned. And that was one of the greatest lessons that he taught me, is when you're too cautious, life completely passes you by. And that to me was learning by example.
Yeah, that was a great, another great section. I mean, the whole book was great. So everyone's got to read this thing. And I'm actually going to give an opportunity for a couple people to win copies of this later on. But to me, this was probably the most relatable book that I've read in a long time. And for, what is it, 260 pages or so? Uh-huh. I read this in two evenings. It was the easiest read I've done in a long time. It's funny. It's insightful. It really hit home to me. And for someone who's, you know, I'd never met you before, never talked to you, I've read your blog, things like that. It also made it a little more personal, because you shared some things in there that I was actually surprised that you put down. I don't know if I would have been so open on some things, but it did play into the relatability aspect of it. And it helped me to go, the guy's being sincere in what he's talking about, because he's sharing so much of himself in this book.
You know, the interesting thing is that anybody I've ever met could write a really ridiculously funny book. I've never met a single person that didn't have some stories that would make me fall off my chair laughing. And, you know, these things are common to all of us. And so that to me was really kind of encouraging, was to think that this book didn't get published because of whatever remarkable circumstance that my life had. It got published because it shows how common we all are. Anybody that I talk to has freaking hilarious stories about people acting silly or people acting, you know, kind of like flawed. A lot of the characters in the book are flawed, and that's what makes it really kind of funny. The other thing too is that when you write a memoir, there's that undeniable fun of thinking, that person was a real jerk to me. I get to put this story in a book.
All right. I got be nice to Gary or he'll
because I have another book coming.
All right. I know whose good side to be on. Unless I want to be in the book, then I'll just be a jerk to you, right?
Right.
Interesting. But on the plus side, you can run any 1-hour photo on the planet, right?
Yeah, I did it with a 20-year span in between my 1-hour photo jobs. Yeah, and that was also another funny thing, is sitting in a 1-hour photo machine for, you know, pretty much all my college years, and then thinking, okay, well, I'm glad to be over that, to 20 years later being sitting at a console again, firing up the lab for Pictage. Yeah.
Now, one thing that you mentioned in the book, you don't go into a tremendous amount of detail, but you bring up Zen meditation.
Yes.
And how does that play into your life today, as it did when you were growing up through it and all the process of learning that?
Well, see, that's the thing that was really, really interesting about the Zen. The irony of that was that it was in my karate training, and you're like thinking, wait, I'm here to learn how to beat up people. Why do you want me to sit in a immovable lotus position for 1 hour on my ass and think about absolutely nothing? It just did not make any sense whatsoever. But once I got into it, this was the thing that was really interesting, is that you find this this calm center core, and it's not really nothingness, like a lot of people, when they try to describe what Zen is, it's not that, yeah, it is the art of nothingness, but what it really is the art of is the art of defocusing. And it's this defocusing that I believe was a really great skill, because it falls right into line without about not having expectations or not setting goals. If you don't really direct yourself in any direction, you let the universe kind of talk to you in a way. And the universe is always sending you messages. If it is, or it's either, you know, they say your inner voice is listening to things. But here's an example. The minute you buy a certain car, like say you buy a Prius, all of a sudden there's Priuses all over the car, you know, all over the streets that you never saw before. You never really realized it, but it's because you now just kind of have a little bit more of a focus on your mind. That's not something that's intentional. When you're headed in a path that you don't really understand yet, and it's all these undercurrents that are kind of happening, if you set an external goal, one that's written down on a piece of paper that's directed and focused and has leverage against it, you really stop listening to the inner voice that's trying to tell you what you really want to do. And it's hard to really explain that, other than that moment when, you know, I saw the Life magazine article with Rocky Gunn. I don't really believe in clues or any kind of strange, you know, metaphysical thing like that. I find them entertaining, but, you know, but when that Rocky Gunn article came up, the minute I'm talking about him, saying, I wonder what this guy's doing now, and I turn the page and there it is. No one shoots weddings like Rocky Gunn. I was like, okay, this is too hard to ignore. I know I have medical school on my path. I know I want to be a musician, but this is like whatever this has got to be looked at a little closer. And that completely changed my axis. So Zen meditation is a great tool for teaching me how to decrease the importance of the things that you're looking at all the time. It's the way to just kind of like sit back and not contemplate anything, which again goes back to that empty cup that begs to be filled.
That's an excellent way of putting that. Do you practice on a regular basis today? Do you meditate for hours in the closet? What's the process as it sits today?
As it sits today, I cannot do it again because it's really kind of boring. You know what? You really can't do Zen meditation until somebody makes you. You know, if you're dumb enough to, no, I don't want to say dumb enough, but I mean, if you sign up for a course and you're paying a certain amount a month and you're, you know, trying to seek this time-honored knowledge, then you'll do it. And once you do it, you start to learn that you can immediately access the center core that is unshakable, cannot be influenced by external events. And I think that's what Zen meditation really is teaching you that there is a deep center core that you can go that cannot be pushed around or shaken. No matter how large life's circumstances can be, you can find that there's a place to go that is a shelter from the storm. And it's not somewhere else. It's deeper, deeper, deeper toward your own center.
How does that play in when you're creating new products? You're always creating new products. You seem to be on a tear lately with some new stuff.
Yeah. The new products basically came because I know as a business person that I have a merchandising channel. When we are in store catalogs and we have the Gary Fong line, then that means that it gives me a license to go to the distributors or to the buyers and say, and this is what we have that's new. That takes away the cost and the risk of purchasing the molds and doing all the cost to design something, because I know that as soon as I make something, we will have stores that buy samples. But a lot of the inventing thing comes from actually going around to the camera stores and meeting the salespeople face to face. I do that probably this year. I've done more of that than any other time, as I actually go to stores big and small, and I have meetings with the camera salespeople, and they tell me what they like about my product or what would be a better product in a particular price range. And so I collect all that information, and I just process it, and then I come up with solutions.
And some of your recent ones would include?
Well, the recent one that I'm really excited about is the flip cage. And that one came completely in the morning when I woke up. I ran straight to a piece of paper and I drew it out and faxed it to my patent attorney. I had a Canon PowerShot 870 that was dented up. I still have it. It couldn't have more dents on it because I took it everywhere that I went. I love the camera. But because it was on a wrist strap, I would constantly bang it into things, reaching for my pocket or whatever. And I also, like you and probably everybody, like taking pictures with me and my buddies with a point and shoot. It might be five of us, and I can't hold it out with my arm, so we would try to find something to sit it on. And I would then take a GorillaPod with me to try to, have it. The tripod. The problem with the GorillaPod or any of those other tripod things, those portable tripods, is it was never with my camera at the same time. So I thought, why can't we have something that protects the camera but is also a tripod? And so in thinking of a solution, I came up with this idea of a turning screw with a friction plate that will lock the legs in a position. When you have the legs up, it puts the camera into a roll cage, completely rubberized roll cage thing that you can drop the camera from 8, 10 feet or whatever, and it won't break the camera because it's coated in rubber. When you loosen the tripod screw, the legs are then free to readjust, which drop down to make a basis for a tripod for either horizontal or vertical. And the other thing, too, is you can swing it around to a third position, which turns it into a micro copy stand. So once we had the ability to do that, then, we showed it to a couple of camera stores and a couple of the retailers. And selling to a camera store is not like selling vacuum cleaners door to door. When you go to a camera store and you bring them something, it to them is a revenue opportunity. And so when they're selling like a Sony CyberShot or something like that, they know that while they're selling that CyberShot, someone might be going, oh, well, would you like to protect it? Would you like to have a tripod that you don't need to carry around that's actually would be built into the camera? And then so that's how we came up with that product. And it's been a lot of fun. It's a lot of our growth now is going into consumer point-and-shoot sales. I think there was something like 300 million Canon PowerShots that have already been made. And that's equal to the number of the people in the United States. So that's a huge market for us.
You think?
Yeah.
Because I two that I'm really interested in are the new Power Snoot and the LightSphere collapsible.
Yeah.
Because I keep the original LightSphere around, and it's so bulky to have in a camera case. I'm always trying to figure out what I can shove that into a hole, and then what else can fit on top of it, like a 50 mil or something, so I don't eat up that big space in my camera bag. But the new collapsible looks really sharp.
Yeah, it's neat. I had one of those rubber collapsible lens shades. You know, the kind that you screw on front of the lens and you can just kind of pop back. I don't know who makes them, but I thought, why don't we do something like that with a LightSphere? That was 2 years ago, and boy, I got to tell you, that was really, really hard to make. We got the prototypes for the first one. We were in New York, and they sent it to me. And I kid you not, I stood on top of it for it took about 10 seconds of all my weight on one foot to make the thing collapse. And it collapsed once, and you couldn't pull it out again. So, it was quite an engineering feat to make that happen. And the other thing, too, is the one-size-fits-all things, you know, because when you're in a camera store and you have all these different sizes, the Lightsphere not being a real easy thing to put away, these poor camera stores would have to have four different sizes of these 5x5 boxes. So now we can... we can squeeze it into a small box. One inch tall is the new collapsible Lightsphere, and one size fits all. So that was kind of cool.
Is there anything new on the horizon that you can share with us?
We've got some really cool, exciting new things that I've been, showing a couple people, but not really ready to announce it because it makes people wonder why it's not out yet. It's like, what's wrong with this? Why isn't it out yet? So if we just kind of like say, boom, here it is, and it's done and it's ready to go, then that's a lot more fun. But yeah, we have really, really cool things coming up. And the neat thing is we bought our plastics manufacturing company in Indiana, and then the distribution warehouse in Wisconsin. We used to be satisfied customers of these two companies, and then I wound up buying them. And what's neat is that we can oversee the quality, keep these things made in the U.S., and we keep a lot of jobs here in the Midwest as well. But we can really quickly ramp up our production. So that's the part that's exciting to me, is that we can create more products faster.
That's really neat, because the products are really, really good. I mean, a lot of people use them. The new flip cage looks really cool. The Lightsphere collapsible looks neat. The snoot looks great. So it looks like you got some neat stuff that you've just come out with. And if this is any indication of where you're going with stuff, I'm thinking you're going to have some cool surprises coming pretty soon.
I hope so. Yeah. You never know if there's no guarantee that these things are going to be well accepted. And if I can sell, one of each, then I'm pretty happy.
It doesn't quite cover the development costs, but
no. But one satisfied customer really does go a long way,
Now, you do have a blog, and what's a little different about your blog is you don't just talk about photography. You tend to be rather opinionated about a number of different topics.
Yeah, that's one flaw of my character, yeah, I would say.
I look at that sometimes, and I'm like, wow, okay. But, the insight that you've had in terms of investing and business seems to be you have a really good track record, let's put it that way.
Thanks.
I wish I would have listened a couple years ago. anyway, but why don't you take a moment and talk about some of the things that you do talk about on your blog for those people who never visit your blog?
Well, with regards to investing, being opinionated is a great thing, and I have people who comment on the blog are opinionated and completely the other way, and that's what makes healthy debate possible. My opinions in the investing world come from the straight up process of asking myself two questions: does an investment, does it have a true value or a perceived one? And if it's moving, is this trend sustainable or not sustainable? And so taking just those two questions, you don't need financial advisors. You don't need Jim Cramer on TV telling you about mad money and how you should invest in Bear Stearns right before the thing goes to zero. You just simply ask yourself those two questions, and it can apply to anything. So when I was talking about gold back in, I think, 2002, when it was $250 an ounce, saying this thing's going to take off, the question was this: does it have value that's real, or is it imagined? And of course it had real value. It always will. Is this trend of it being this low price sustainable or not sustainable? And I didn't think it was sustainable. The thing about investing is, and I really love this, I'm not a real huge fan of Alan Greenspan, but he said something that made just crystal clear sense to me. He said that financial forecasting is nothing but finding where the imbalances lie and asking yourself, where will they ultimately resolve? So it's just like the housing prices. I wrote a lot about it back when it was going up like crazy. And I didn't. I stopped buying real estate in the United States, I think, around 2002 or something like that. And I kept saying it's going to crash. Why was it going to crash? Because there was a house in Inglewood. I think it was 800 square feet, had bars all over the window. And Inglewood is a really, really not a great part of town. Lots of crime, lots of gang wars and things like that. Center hallway and just, I think, two bedrooms and one bath. And this house was going for over $800,000. And I'm asking myself, does this house really have an $800,000 value? And it's going up. Is this sustainable? And the answer to both of those questions was no. And that's how you can detect an asset bubble forming. And so that's basically my entire investment strategy has been that.
But you also have a couple other rules when it comes to your personal investments and how you look at different things to see if you want to actually put money into them.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, it's never a good idea to invest and want a return. I know that sounds really crazy, but the best way to invest is just to take the money as if it's gone and you'll never see it again. That way, you really won't be emotional about watching stock prices. I remember the few stocks that I did choose, I spent more time going back to the, you know, watching today's Dow Jones or whatever, and I didn't get any work done because I was too worried about the incremental moves up and down that a stock would have. So it just absolutely drove me crazy. So the idea of investing is to invest like the money's completely gone and you'll never see it again, but put it in areas where there's an imbalance.
We are going to give away a couple copies of the book, which I think everybody should read because it's a different approach. And I think that's really needed these days, is a different way of looking at things. And as much as I was a big Zig Ziglar and Tony Robbins and all those guys kind of fan, that never worked for me either. And not that I really want to just sit back on the couch and wait for life to happen. That's not my style either. But to be prepared for things that can come up and sometimes be willing to take the risk. I mean, obviously not everyone can take, you know, some types of risks. You have to balance that against your personal stability and your responsibilities and things. But if you're not open to opportunities, you're going to miss them.
Correct. Yeah.
So I came up with a fun, what I think hopefully is going to be a fun little contest for people. Okay. And what I'm going to do is it's there's going to be a randomness to it. So I'm going to do a random drawing, but in order to enter the drawing, they have to go to your blog, which there'll be a link in the show notes, but it's GaryFong1.Zanga.com, XANGA.com. And you're going to have to go back a little bit and you're going to have to find the animal that makes for a good pet.
Okay. That's awesome.
And you're going to send an email to contest@cameradojo.com with the answer to that question, what animal makes for a good pet? And let me pick a date here.
Brilliant.
You like that?
Yeah, it's awesome.
How about January 15th? I'll pull a couple names and I'll send you guys out copies of the book. And I know I'm going to pass the book around to all my friends around here and beat them upside the head until they read it. Because I think there's some really good information in there, especially if you want to run a 1-hour photo booth. There's some excellent stuff in there about that. But you also have some good insight into to how you did things differently in terms of wedding photography, pricing, and just looking at things a different way instead of trying to do what's normal or what's considered traditional.
You know, there's so many things that don't work, and it's all around us. And the thing I think that just drives me crazy is when we accept dumb things that don't really work that well, and we're okay with that. I think that's And wedding photography was one of the hugest, where it wasn't merchandised properly, it wasn't actually shot properly or packaged properly, and but everybody was okay with it, and they were just like, no, but that's how it's done, and that just drives me crazy.
So, kind of like the Electoral College.
Exactly.
Throw that out there. That's my little jab.
Okay. There you go. Right. Or Britain's monarchy.
Yeah. But it's what I like is the approach that it's okay to do things different, and many times doing something different is the right thing to do. And I think a lot of us can learn from that in a lot of different ways. And quit trying to, well, you know, the definition of lunacy, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I believe that's even in your book, right?
Right.
And so many of us go down that path. We keep doing the same dumb thing over and over that we know isn't working, and we expect it to all of a sudden be different tomorrow.
Yeah, that's sad and it's empty.
I see that all over the place with photographers today. They're doing, not that there's anything inherently wrong with social media. I mean, and used properly, it can be a powerful tool. But I see photographers marketing to other photographers. And they're wondering why they're not getting business. Well, because you need to be marketing to potential clients. But, why is that a weird concept?
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many people who just, you know, start and they start workshops. It's like almost the second thing that they do. Shoot a wedding and then do a workshop.
You say that now that I just announced my first workshop.
Well.
That's all right. That's all right. It took a lot of encouragement from a lot of people for me to finally do it. And I'm glad I'm doing it. I'm excited about it. And I'm doing it with Jules Bianchi. And I couldn't be more thrilled to be doing a workshop.
Finally. You know what? Workshops are great. What you'll really get most from it is by teaching others what you do, you learn better what you do. It's weird.
Oh, and that's why I love teaching. I absolutely love it. That's why I love doing Camera Dojo and doing the podcast. I think I get far more out of it than my readers and my listeners.
Correct. Yeah. It fine tunes your skills by trying to think about how to explain what it is that you do.
Absolutely. For me, it's huge. And, you know, people say, oh, you know, it's so great of you to be giving all the time, but that's really not it. There's, I get a lot out of it. It's not just altruism. It's, I truly benefit from it.
Yeah, there's a good energy in that.
But what, since we're kind of on that, what is your take on the whole social networking phenomenon going on?
Well, it takes what used to take probably 20 times longer, and it just speeds it up. It accelerates it fast. And when you look at the evolution from the blog to Facebook and now to Twitter, it's basically taken, like, you know, a blog, you have to sit down, you have to think about what you're going to write. It has to be kind of interesting, or else really you're not going to have anybody who cares about what you wrote or what you posted. Then you took it to Facebook. Facebook was a little bit more rapid. You can just, you know, come up with something and then it would instantly be on somebody's notice. And then you take it to Twitter, which is interesting, 141 characters, and but it's super rapid. So what you're doing is you're basically able to distribute your message, whatever the message may be. You know, Brittany Murphy died, or you have a new sale on children's portraiture. It allows you to broadcast much faster in a much less sophisticated way without having to hassle too much. That's great for that reason. Where it probably can go to some detriment is when a person uses that as kind of like a Wikipedia. When a person says, you know, I'm going to become a photographer. I wonder what other people charge, or I wonder what other people do. And then they basically stop this process of being completely open to what, like me, to redefining thing or asking yourselves what's wrong and thinking the expectation is this. People expect you to put a Photoshop action on everything, you know, or they expect you to have trash the dress session with every wedding that you shoot. These fads can just pop up like little wildfires really quick. And what it is, it is takes away the need for some people to be even more inventive. to be a little bit more asking yourself, what can I do that's more individual to me?
It creates more of a me too attitude?
It does, because there's so much to out there. So when you're trying to define me, then it's too easy just to go, oh, well, you know, I must retouch every single photo so that I make everybody look like a burn victim, or or, you know, aged film is the new look. I don't know. We tried forever to get away from aged film, and now we're shooting beautiful, clean digital images, and we're making them look like old film. But, you know, that's okay by me. But yeah, it's very, very easy to define yourself by what's out there, because there's the trends can pop up quicker and then just as easily be replaced by another trend. And with all of that input coming on, it doesn't challenge a photographer enough to say, who am I? And what is it that I really think that I want to do with photography? What do I want to do with my clients? It kind of takes that away.
Do you think that some people are putting a little too much of themselves out there? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think people actually aren't putting themselves out there enough individually as individuals. I think that people are coming out quite like a group. They identify with a certain speaker or a certain ideology group, and in order to become accepted quickly, they say, you know, I'm one of these types. And that's always happened with photography. When Dennis Reggie came out with photojournalism, the few that started, and then it started to just go all over the place like popcorn, people would say, I'm a photojournalist, and it started happening like that. So a lot of times photographers would just kind of take things and identify with a particular group rather than put themselves out there as an individual and say, I'm going to be this type of a person. And that's harder to do now because there's so many people broadcasting.
Do you think it's good for people to really know so much about you from a personal level? When, you know, I mean, your book is clearly, you know, an exception because it's kind of designed for that. But on things like social networking, when people are putting out their religious beliefs or their political beliefs, and or should it be more of a marketing tool? Or is there a middle ground somewhere?
Yeah, there has to be a balance, and I'm guilty of that. Or I put my ideology out there sometimes, because we get seduced by this idea of, now that people are listening to me and now that people like certain things, it does play with your head a little bit, and you start to think, you know, I'm going to put more of myself out there, and that's fine. But it is a really dicey balance between your personal opinion and business, and I do think that sometimes people put it out there a bit too much. Like, for example, religion. I don't know how this has come into the discussion of photography so much, but it gets into politics and everything like that. There's a lot of people who put their religion into their photography, and in a way, I can't say that that's a bad idea, because I'm also saying, you know, put yourself into whatever it is that you do, and if a lot of your core is your religious beliefs, then I can't say that that's bad. But I can also say that there will be people who don't relate and will segment themselves out of your audience just on the basis of that. And so, you know, you can find a following that is more your core beliefs, and there'll be a more loyal following, but you might find some really interesting people who might really be big fans that just on the basis of one thing that you've said have made a snap decision about you as a person. And that is the risk you take when you identify yourself as part of a particular group.
Because I always struggle with that as to, do I really want to make a comment on something? Michael Jackson's death, you know, something that just is either moving towards me or something that's irritating towards me. I go, man, am I going to really piss people off if I say what I really feel, or should I just keep my mouth shut and, you know, just not voice my opinion out to, you know, thousands of people all in one shot?
You will always anger somebody. Yeah, that's true.
Well, you can't please everybody, that's for sure.
No, no. But the people who then decide that they like you really for you, and you're not being a fake person. So, you know, like, was it Chris Rock said, when you're dating somebody, you're not dating them, you're dating the representative. it's pretty easy in the blog world to try to pretend to be something that's, you know, less flawed than you really are. And I think that's one of the appeals of blogs and Facebook and Twitter. The funniest tweets that I see is when somebody does something really dumb and then they broadcast it to all of their followers. And I think, why would this person share this with me? You know, but it's funny and it makes them kind of more lovable and even more approachable. And I think that's the positive part of social networking, is that it makes you more approachable. So.
It certainly can, and sometimes in a good way, and sometimes not. That's for sure. But we're coming up on an hour. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I really appreciate you coming on. I think the book was fantastic, and I'm not saying that just to blow smoke. I really thought it was a great book, totally relatable to me. I'm sure it can really help a lot of other people out there. Maybe there's going to be people who just go, oh, my God, shut down and not think about things and not be goal-oriented. May just be a little too much for them.
But see, if that were really the truth, then the book would have no pages.
True.
Right. You know, I mean, if what you're saying is true, that, you know, the minute I decided to stop trying, then nothing happened, and I'm still sitting on the same couch that I was from that moment on, then the book would really have had no circumstance or events. And I find almost the opposite happening, because when I diagram out my business activities or my life so far, you know, owning the plastics company and the warehouse distribution company in Wisconsin, or having, you know, helped started Pictage, or, you know, all these other things, I can tell you this, none of those things was ever a goal. It was never a goal to have all those things happen. And had I had a goal, none of those things would have happened, because they're too random. It just doesn't make sense to be, you know, an author. If I made it a goal to be an author, that's a pretty lofty goal. And I might have spent so many years trying to be published that I wouldn't have done any of the other things. So it's even though it may sound like it's anti-motivational, I just kind of think that the less you pressure yourself to do something, the more things actually just pop in your mind that create opportunities that make complete sense.
But don't everybody just go kick back and don't do anything, because that's not not how it works. And you actually relate that in the book. You know, you were on a business trip, you pulled out a new magazine, and there was this ad for a plastics company, which led you to start thinking about something totally different. And it's that one thing led to another.
That's right.
And it's not you were just sitting there and all of a sudden, bing, something happened. It's through the process of doing something else, some other thing came up which sidetracked you, but you were willing to look at it and look at that opportunity.
Yeah, because setting goals and having expectations, one thing leads to one thing. And that's, you know, there's no surprise in that. Whereas when you're just preparing for something and you wind up on a completely different spot than you ever thought would have existed, that's when life's a really neat adventure.
Well, it sounds like you've had a good adventure.
Yeah, it's been really fun and funny, too. That was the main thing about the book, is that people are very, very funny.
They can be, that's for sure. So, again, the book, The Accidental Millionaire, How to Succeed in Life Without Really Trying, from Gary Fong. Check it out. There'll be links in the show notes for it. Gary, thank you so much. I was very careful not to call you Mr. Fong, so, because I read that in the book, right? Because you're like a big, huge celebrity, and they like to be called by their first names. So I took that to heart, right? So, so Gary, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Thanks.
I hope you all got a lot out of that. I know it was very interesting for me to sit and talk to Gary for a while, especially having just read his book, and I did read it. It's a really fast read. I did it in two evenings. I'm going to reread it here pretty soon, because there was a lot of good information in it. But check it out, the contest. Again, real simple. Go to Gary's website, garyfong1.xanda.com. Link is in the show notes, so you don't have to worry about it. And you need to find out what animal makes for a good pet. Send your entry to contest@cameradojo.com with the subject Gary Fong Contest, and you'll be entered to win. We'll do a random drawing on January 15th, and that person will get signed copies of Gary's book. So there is going to be a collector's item for you. Again, check out the Light, Location, and Love workshop at cameradojo.com or on julescafe.com. And all the new articles that we're posting, I just did a preview of the new Lens Baby soft focus and wide angle lenses. So check that out on cameradojo.com. You can follow the show on Twitter, twitter.com/cameradojo, or facebook.com/cameradojo. This has been your host, Kerry Garrison. We'll talk to you next time.